Hi, it's Scott. It's Thursday, April 9th, and I am reading from the Spring 2026 edition of Diabetes Management magazine. This story is titled, Your Spring Diabetes Check-In. Essential screenings, nutrition updates, mental health support, and small daily habits that can help you stay ahead of long-term complications. It's written by Paul Wynn. When C.J. Walker was first told she had type 2 diabetes at age 38, the diagnosis didn't quite make sense to her. Petite, active, and health conscious, she had few of the classic risk factors. Instead of accepting the answer at face value, Walker started digging deeper. She read reputable medical websites, paid close attention to what other women shared at Diabetes Sisters meetups, and prepared detailed questions for her doctors. That persistence paid off. After advocating for more specialized testing and finding an endocrinologist willing to investigate further, she learned that she had actually had latent autoimmune diabetes in adults, known as LADA. It's a slow-progressing form of type 1 diabetes that is often misdiagnosed as type 2 diabetes. Today, she's not only managing her condition with precision, but she also leads workshops and meetups to empower others to research, advocate, and work proactively with their healthcare teams. Walker, who's a business owner in Richmond, Virginia, said, I walked into every doctor's appointment armed with research and questions. I wasn't trying to challenge the doctor. I was trying to partner with them so we could get to the right diagnosis and treatment together. Her story reflects a growing movement among people who are living with diabetes, a story where education, self-advocacy, and collaborative care can lead to better outcomes. Experts seem to agree that this proactive approach can make a meaningful difference in day-to-day management and long-term health. Patients who take an active role, tracking their data, asking questions, and staying on top of preventive care, do see the best outcomes. That, according to Dr. Adham Mottolieb, who's an endocrinologist and obesity medicine specialist with the Adult Diabetes Clinic at Joslin Diabetes Center here in Boston. One of the most powerful tools in diabetes care is knowing how to work closely with your healthcare team. Dr. Mottolieb emphasizes that patients achieve the best results when they actively collaborate with their healthcare team rather than simply following instructions. Diabetes care works best, he says, when patients see their doctors as partners in their care, working together to find the right diagnosis and treatment. A strong patient-provider partnership includes several key behaviors. They include bringing questions and observations to medical appointments. Patients should come prepared with notes about symptoms, glucose readings, lifestyle changes, or any concerns about side effects of medication. This is the kind of information that helps clinicians tailor their care plans more accurately. Asking about new medications, diabetes technologies, and monitoring tools can uncover options that may improve daily disease management. Shared decision-making is another key behavior. Appointments should feel like a conversation rather than a one-sided directive. Discussing treatment options, lab results, and personal goals helps assure that decisions fit a patient's lifestyle and priorities. Also, coordinating care across providers. Many people with diabetes see multiple medical professionals, primary care doctors, endocrinologists, dietitians, mental health providers, and others. Keeping all the clinicians updated on lab results, medication changes, and new concerns helps prevent conflicting advice and helps assure a cohesive care plan. Consistency and follow-up are important. Regular check-ins with your specialists and primary care providers allow the care team to monitor progress, adjust medications, and catch potential complications early on. And advocate for support services. Patients should feel empowered to ask about tools and resources that may help them. Things like continuous glucose monitors or insulin pumps, mental health support if needed, or referrals to specialists like an endocrinologist, a dietitian, or a diabetes educator. And finally, reviewing key diabetes targets is always important. Regularly going over A1C goals, a measure of glucose levels over the previous 2 to 3 months, time in range data, and glucose trends gives both the patient and the provider a clearer picture of how well blood sugar is being managed. These metrics help guide decisions about medications, nutrition, activity level, and other lifestyle changes. For Lindsay Cohen, who is a registered dietitian and diabetes educator, nutrition is the foundation of effective diabetes care. She is living with type 1 diabetes herself, so she's able to help patients understand how everyday food choices impact blood sugar, energy, and overall well-being. But Lindsay Cohen emphasizes that diabetes management isn't only about what's on the food plate. It's also about how the food interacts with medications, physical activity, stress levels, and daily routine. Cohen says that conversations about diet often get squeezed out of busy medical appointments. Doctors want to help, she says, but they may not have the time or detailed nutrition training to really dig into what someone is eating on a day-to-day basis. That's where registered dietitians, like her, especially those who specialize in diabetes, can play a major role. Cohen encourages her patients to ask doctors for a referral to a dietitian who can take the time to assess eating patterns, identify problem areas, and create an individualized meal plan. Insurance often covers visits with dietitians, she says, but many people don't realize that. You don't have to figure out your own nutritional goals on your own. To make the most of an appointment, she recommends bringing a few basics: a 3-day food log, 2 weekdays and 1 weekend day, any glucose patterns that you've noticed, and a list of specific questions or challenges you'd like to address. It can give us a real snapshot of what's typical for the person, Cohen says. That's how we can offer realistic advice and help make sustainable change. For people who are living with diabetes, mental health isn't a sidebar. It's often a major factor in how well the condition is managed. Stress, anxiety, and depression can directly influence blood sugar levels. And Dr. Mottolieb emphasizes that emotional well-being and glucose management are closely linked. He says mental health challenges can derail diabetes and many other aspects of a person's health if they aren't addressed. The COVID-19 pandemic only intensified those pressures, he says, making honest conversations about emotional coping even more important during routine medical visits. Access to mental health support, however, remains a significant hurdle for many. Dr. Mottolieb encourages clinicians to proactively ask about stress and emotional well-being, and when appropriate, refer patients to therapists, social workers, or consider medications such as antidepressants. Dr. Mottolieb also says that diabetes technologies, things like CGMs and insulin pumps, can lighten the daily burden of decision-making for patients, helping some people feel more in control and less overwhelmed. Cohen echoes this perspective. Stress, anxiety, and emotional fatigue can all influence blood sugar patterns, she says, which make it essential to address mental health alongside nutrition, medication, and physical activity. She encourages patients to bring up emotional challenges during clinic visits and seek support from available mental health resources. Mental health isn't separate from diabetes care, she says. It affects every part of your management, so speaking up is the first step toward preventing bigger problems. Walker emphasizes that managing diabetes doesn't have to feel overwhelming, and it doesn't definitely need to be tackled all at once. Instead, she encourages people to focus on small, achievable goals that they can build on over time, rather than attempting drastic lifestyle changes that are harder to sustain. Small steps like these could include checking blood sugar more consistently, adding a short walk after lunch, swapping one weekly meal for a healthier option, or making minor adjustments to medication routines, with a healthcare provider's guidance, of course. Incremental improvements, Walker says, are more realistic, easier to maintain, and far more effective in the long run. As she says, big progress comes from small, consistent action. Each step forward is a win for your health. By celebrating those small victories, people living with diabetes can build habits that support long-term disease management. This next story is entitled Seven Ways to Lower Your Dementia Risk. Simple, science-backed habits that support brain health, especially if you have type 2 diabetes. And the story is written by Amy Campbell. She's a registered dietitian, a certified diabetes care and education specialist, and lead and program manager at an organization called Good Measures, LLC. Dementia is something many people are all too familiar with, perhaps through a parent, a partner, a relative, or a friend who has lived with this challenging condition. While growing older is the strongest risk factor, of course, other elements can raise the likelihood of developing dementia, and type 2 diabetes is one of them. This may feel unsettling, but there's also some good news. Research continues to show that lifestyle plays a powerful role. So, by focusing on healthy habits, especially those that support heart and metabolic health, you can meaningfully lower your risk and support your brain as you age. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, dementia is not a single disease. Rather, it's a general term that's used to describe a decline in memory, thinking, or decision-making that interferes with daily life. Alzheimer's disease is, of course, the most common form, affecting memory, thinking, and behavior. It accounts for between 60 and 80% of dementia cases, according to the Alzheimer's Association. In the United States, it's estimated that about 5 million adults, age 65 and older, were living with dementia in 2014. By the year 2060, that number is projected to reach nearly 14 million. While the risk of dementia does increase with age, it's important to remember that it's not an inevitable part of getting older. As the National Institute on Aging points out, many people live well into their 90s and beyond with no signs of dementia at all. Dementia can look different from one person to the next. Typically, it does involve difficulties, though, in several key areas. They include memory, attention and concentration, communication, reasoning, judgment, and problem-solving, visual perception, and spatial awareness. All these challenges can show up in everyday life in many different ways. Examples of symptoms that may signal dementia include trouble speaking, understanding, or expressing thoughts, difficulty reading or writing, getting lost or wandering in a familiar neighborhood, problems managing bills, money, or other routine household tasks, asking the same questions repeatedly, taking longer to complete normal daily activities, losing interest in hobbies or usual activities, seeing or hearing things that aren't there, acting impulsively or showing poor judgment, problems with balance or movement, and showing less concern for other people's feelings. A number of factors can increase the risk of developing dementia. Some are things we can't change, while others are linked to lifestyle or overall health. Risk factors include increasing age, a family history of dementia, Down syndrome, race and ethnicity. In the U.S., older African American and Hispanic Latino adults are diagnosed with dementia at higher rates than white adults. That's likely due to differences in health conditions, access to care, and other social determinants of health. Traumatic brain injury is also a factor, as are heart disease and other cardiovascular conditions. Type 2 diabetes, depression, sleep apnea, excessive alcohol use, smoking, physical inactivity, hearing loss, poor diet or nutrition deficiencies, and long-term use of certain medications with strong anticholinergic effects, for example, some allergy or sleep medicines that contain diphenhydramine. The good news is that many of these risk factors are modifiable by taking steps such as improving diet, being more physically active, quitting smoking, managing health conditions like diabetes or sleep apnea, and limiting alcohol. You can meaningfully lower your risk of dementia. A study published in the journal Neurology in 2022 followed more than 167,000 adults age 60 and older, including over 12,000 people with type 2 diabetes. Participants in the study were tracked for an average of 12 years and were given a lifestyle score ranging from 0 to 7, based on whether they met these 7 behaviors: a healthy diet, regular physical activity, less sedentary behavior, adequate sleep, not smoking, moderate alcohol intake, and frequent social contact. Over the course of that study, 4,300 participants developed dementia. As expected, people with diabetes had a higher risk of dementia than those without diabetes. But there was encouraging news, too. Participants who followed more of these healthy lifestyle habits had a significantly lower risk of developing dementia. And this protective effect was even stronger among those with diabetes. Having type 2 diabetes doesn't mean you will develop dementia. As the study showed, lifestyle choices can make a meaningful difference. Here are some steps to help you get started. Eat a brain-healthy diet. There's no single magic diet that can prevent dementia, but one eating pattern that has been widely studied for brain health is the so-called MIND diet. MIND stands for Mediterranean-Intervention for Neurodegenerative Delay Diet. It combines elements of the Mediterranean and DASH diets and emphasizes foods that are linked to better cognitive function. It encourages eating vegetables, especially leafy greens, berries, whole grains, fish and poultry, beans, nuts, and olive oil. The MIND diet also recommends limiting foods like red meat, cheese, butter, and margarine, sweets, and fast or fried foods. Next, stay physically active. Being physically active is one of the best ways to reduce risk of dementia, according to the Alzheimer's Society. Research consistently shows that middle-aged and older adults who engage in regular aerobic activity do show improvement in memory and thinking skills, as well as lower rates of dementia. The Alzheimer's Association also says that up to one-third of Alzheimer's cases may be preventable through physical activity and other healthy lifestyle behaviors. More good news? Being active doesn't require running marathons or spending hours at the gym. Choose activities you enjoy: walking, dancing, gardening, or even vigorous housework. If you haven't been active, start slowly and build your way up. Aim for about 30 minutes of activity spread throughout the day on most days of the week. And try to remember, you're never too old to start moving. Even small increases in activity can make a meaningful difference. Next, cut back on sedentary time. Being physically active is important, but reducing sedentary time is a different and equally valuable goal. What you do while sitting seems to matter just as much as how long you sit. A study published in the journal PNAS in August of 2022 found that not all sedentary activities carry the same level of risk. Spending long periods watching television, for example, which is a more passive activity, was linked with a higher risk of dementia. In contrast, spending time on a computer, which tends to be more mentally stimulating, was linked with a lower risk, even after accounting for physical activity. This doesn't mean you should avoid sitting altogether, of course. Instead, try to make some of your seated time more mentally active. Challenge your brain by reading, doing puzzles, playing strategy or word games, learning a new language, or even practicing simple math problems. Keeping your mind engaged can help support brain health over time. Next, prioritize your sleep. Getting enough sleep is linked to a lower risk of dementia. Many experts recommend aiming for about 7 to 9 hours of sleep each night. In one long-term study, sleeping fewer than 5 hours per night was associated with double the risk of developing dementia compared with getting adequate sleep. Researchers are still uncovering exactly why insufficient sleep may increase dementia risk. But one theory is that deep sleep helps the brain clear out waste products, including beta amyloid, which is the protein that can form Alzheimer's plaque, along with other potentially harmful substances. Next, stop smoking. Most people, of course, know that smoking harms the lungs and heart, but it also affects the brain. Smoking has been linked to a higher risk of cognitive decline and dementia. In fact, one large study found that people who smoke are about 30% more likely to develop dementia and 40% more likely to develop Alzheimer's disease compared with those who do not smoke. The encouraging news is that quitting smoking can lower your risk over time. Never smoking is best, of course, but stopping at any age is beneficial. And it's never too late for your brain to benefit from quitting smoking. That said, however, quitting can be challenging, and many people need several attempts and help before they can succeed. If you're thinking about stopping, there are proven tools and resources that can help you. To get started, visit the website smokefree.gov. Next, limit alcohol, or skip it altogether. Drinking too much alcohol over long periods of time can damage the brain and increase the risk of alcohol-related dementia. Heavy drinking can directly injure brain cells, which can lead to problems with memory, learning, judgment, and decision-making. Chronic alcohol use also can cause nutritional deficiencies, especially thiamine, vitamin B1, which further harm the brain. Treatment for alcohol-related dementia, or ARD, focuses on stopping alcohol use, correcting nutritional deficiencies, and following a healthy diet. Some symptoms may improve with time and support, but others, particularly issues with learning and short-term memory, may not fully reverse. If you choose to drink alcohol, keep it moderate, up to 2 drinks per day for men, and 1 drink per day for women. Even within these limits, it's wise to remember that drinking less is generally better for long-term brain and overall health. If you're concerned about your drinking or would like support in cutting back, visit the SAMHSA, which is Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration website, at samhsa.gov for confidential help and resources. Next, stay socially connected. According to the CDC, social isolation is linked to about a 50% increased risk of dementia. Older adults are more likely to experience isolation for many reasons. They live alone, they've lost friends or family members, they're managing a chronic illness or dealing with a hearing loss issue. Social isolation is also associated with higher rates of depression, anxiety, suicide, heart disease, and stroke. The encouraging news is that staying socially connected can help protect brain health. Spending regular, meaningful time with friends and family is a great way to start. Getting involved in shared activities, things like taking a class, joining a club, attending community events, or volunteering, also can help people stay engaged and meet others with similar interests. If you're finding yourself increasingly lonely or disconnected, the Centers for Disease Control offers helpful resources and guidance at cdc.gov/social-connectedness. Reaching out for support is an important part of maintaining both mental and cognitive health. Dementia isn't entirely preventable, but the choices you make every day can help keep your brain healthier as you age. Whether you're taking a short walk, cooking a colorful meal, calling a friend, or turning in a little earlier each night, each step you take supports your well-being. Even modest improvements in lifestyle can make a difference, and you don't have to make them all at once. Start where you are. Your brain will thank you. This next story from the spring 2026 edition of Diabetes Self-Management magazine is entitled Beyond Carbs: What Really Drives Blood Glucose After Meals? It's written by Lorena Drago. She's a registered dietitian nutritionist and a certified diabetes care and educational specialist who specializes in the multicultural aspects of diabetes self-management education. From a nutrition perspective, managing type 1 diabetes or type 2 diabetes isn't just about counting carbohydrates. While carb counting is certainly important, it's only part of the story. What you eat and when you eat also matters. Fat, protein, and fiber all influence how your body processes food and affect blood glucose, or sugar, levels. For example, eating carbohydrates with protein, fat, or fiber slows digestion and the rise in blood glucose. A meal that's higher in fat and protein may require a different insulin dose than one that's lower in those nutrients, even if both contain the same amount of carbohydrates. Timing also plays a role. If insulin is taken too early or too late, or if the dose doesn't match the amount or type of food eaten, blood glucose can climb too high or drop too low. Understanding how nutrients and meal combinations affect your glucose response can help you fine-tune your strategies for smoother management. To explore this further, I spoke with two registered dietitians and a registered nurse who live with diabetes themselves and support people who do so every day. They are Gregory LaFortune. He's founder of Optimal Plan Nutrition, LLC, which specializes in men's health, diabetes management, and performance nutrition. Diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at age 11, he was inspired to pursue a career in nutrition. He is a registered dietitian himself. Bridget Wood, who is founder of Bridget Wood Wellness, LLC, works with diabetes organizations and was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at age 17. She now dedicates her life to advocacy and education. She is also a registered dietitian and a certified diabetes educator. Betsy Rodriguez, who describes herself as a pancreas mom to a daughter with type 1 diabetes, lives with type 2 diabetes herself and is a nurse and a certified diabetes care and education specialist. Together, these three people shared real-world insights on managing glucose beyond just carb counting, from insulin timing and food combinations to everyday hacks that make a difference. Carbohydrates are the body's main source of energy and the primary nutrient affecting blood glucose. When you eat carbohydrate-containing foods, your digestive system breaks them down into glucose, which enters the bloodstream. In people without diabetes, the pancreas continuously releases small amounts of basal insulin to keep blood glucose steady between meals. When you eat, the rise in glucose signals the pancreas to release a burst of insulin that moves glucose from the blood into cells for energy. In diabetes, this process is disrupted. The body may not make enough insulin, in the case of type 1 diabetes, or may not use it effectively, in type 2 diabetes. It allows glucose to build up in the blood. To manage this, people with diabetes may take basal insulin for ongoing needs and mealtime or prandial insulin to handle post-meal rises. Carbohydrates make up the main nutrient in foods such as bread, rice, pasta, tortillas, cereals, starchy vegetables, beans, lentils, milk, yogurt, fruit, and sweets. Because these foods vary in the type and amount of carbohydrate they provide, learning how they affect your blood glucose and how to balance them with protein, fat, and fiber can help keep glucose levels steadier. If you live with type 1 diabetes, you may notice that meals like cheeseburgers, pizza, or fried foods don't spike your glucose right away. Instead, levels may rise hours later. Dietary fat slows digestion and delays glucose absorption, meaning the insulin you take for carbs alone may not fully match that delayed rise. Protein and fat can raise insulin needs. Compared with lower fat, lower protein meals that contain the same carbs, higher fat or higher protein meals often require more insulin and/or an extended delivery window. Clinical guidance, along with emerging research, increasingly recommend considering fat and protein, not just carbohydrates, when adjusting mealtime insulin, especially for higher fat mixed meals. Fat amount matters most. Total fat load is consistently linked with delayed hyperglycemia, or high blood glucose. Research on fat type is mixed. Some studies have shown extra virgin olive oil may lessen spikes, while meals with high saturated fat sources, such as butter, may delay the glucose peak and, in some cases, lead to later sustained elevations in glucose. Emphasize total fat first and monitor your individual response. Timing counts. Because glucose rises are delayed, adjusting insulin delivery, for example, using a dual wave or extended bolus on a pump or splitting injections, can better match digestion. Studies support these strategies for mixed meals like pizza, for example. Practical dosing. Some people may find success by giving part of their mealtime dose up front and the rest over 60 to 120 minutes for higher fat meals. Exact percentages and timing must be individualized with continuous glucose monitor feedback along with guidance from your healthcare providers. Sample menus to visualize fat ranges. These examples show how increasing fat changes a meal's nutrient balance and potentially insulin needs. They're not meal plans or dosing guides. Always work with your diabetes care team to personalize your approach. About 20 grams of fat, about 50 to 55 grams carbs, about 35 to 40 grams protein. 4 ounces of grilled chicken breast, 1 cup cooked quinoa plus 1 tablespoon toasted sunflower seeds, 1 cup roasted broccoli plus 1 teaspoon of olive oil, 2 tablespoons of sliced avocado. About 40 grams of fat, about 55 grams carbs, about 40 grams protein, 4 ounces of grilled chicken breast, plus 1 teaspoon of olive oil, 1 cup cooked quinoa, plus 1 tablespoon of toasted sunflower seeds, 1 cup roasted broccoli, and 2 teaspoons of olive oil and garlic, along with half a sliced avocado and 1 ounce of feta. About 60 grams of fat, about 55 grams of carbs, about 45 grams of protein, 4 ounces of grilled chicken breast, plus a teaspoon of olive oil, 1 cup of cooked quinoa, plus 2 tablespoons of toasted sunflower seeds, 1 cup of roasted broccoli, plus 2 teaspoons of olive oil and garlic, half a sliced avocado, plus 1 ounce of feta, plus 1 ounce of walnuts. How are experts put all this into practice? Gregory LaFortune, with type 1 diabetes, delivers part of his bolus before eating and the rest later for higher fat meals. Bridget Wood, also with type 1 diabetes, weighs fat first, then protein and carbs, and uses her pump's extended bolus to spread delivery. Betsy Rodriguez, who has type 2 diabetes, adjusts portions, notes late rises after moderate to high-fat foods such as tostones or alcapurrias, confirmed by her continuous glucose monitor. LaFortune and Wood rely on CGM trend arrows and post-meal patterns to fine-tune their approaches, while Rodriguez focuses on balanced portions and monitoring. High-fiber foods, vegetables, beans, lentils, peas, whole grains, and fruits, help blunt post-meal spikes by slowing absorption. Soluble fiber, like psyllium, can further reduce after-meal glucose when consumed before eating. Some people find they need slightly less or delayed insulin with very high-fiber meals to avoid lows. Use CGM or fingerstick data to guide adjustments. When you eat carbs like bread, tortillas, or pasta, your glucose naturally goes up. But the order of foods does matter. Eating carbohydrates after protein and non-starchy vegetables, such as chicken, fish, or salad, can slow digestion and moderate spikes. Research has shown that eating protein and vegetables before carbohydrates can reduce post-meal rises by 25 to 30% in people with type 2 diabetes compared with eating the carbs first. This simple shift will help keep glucose steadier. For rapid-acting insulin, Bridget Wood suggests dosing about 10 to 20 minutes before lower-fiber meals to align insulin action with the glucose rise. For higher-fiber meals, she doses closer to eating or even at mealtime, since fiber does slow absorption and delays glucose entry into the bloodstream. She also reviews trend arrows on her CGM to help fine-tune her timing. Gregory LaFortune adds that learning how food combinations affect glucose has been key to improving his diabetes management and to helping his clients do the same. Your continuous glucose monitor isn't just a number on a screen. It's your personal glucose GPS. This tool is powerful and helps you see how meals, activity, stress, and sleep affect glucose in real time. LaFortune credits CGM technology with being life-saving and says it's helped him reach his best A1C over the previous 2 to 3 months since his diagnosis. Read the arrows, not just the numbers. Your CGM shows both your current glucose and its direction. If glucose is 110 milligrams per deciliter and the arrow points up, it may rise 60 to 90 milligrams per deciliter within 30 minutes. Acting early through a correction bolus or light activity can help prevent spikes. If glucose is 110 milligrams per deciliter and trending down, it could drop 60 to 90 milligrams per deciliter soon. You may need less insulin or a small snack. Use event markers to track meals, exercise, stress, or illness. Review your reports every few weeks and ask these questions. Are lows happening after exercise? Are highs linked to certain meals or high-fat foods? Do the lows follow aggressive corrections? Are overnight spikes or dips consistent? Rodriguez notes that a lack of sleep raises her glucose, and her CGM data helps her spot that pattern. Review time below range first, then time above range to pinpoint adjustments. CGMs are invaluable for identifying overnight trends, so use the overnight data to your advantage. If lows appear, check whether they're true hypoglycemia or compression lows from lying on the sensor. Persistent highs or lows may indicate a need to adjust basal insulin with your care team's guidance. There are other factors that influence post-meal glucose as well. While food and insulin timing are key, those other factors include stress. Hormones like cortisol can raise glucose independent of food. Rodriguez is especially sensitive to stress and sees it clearly on her CGM. Hydration is another. Even mild dehydration can make glucose much harder to manage. Drink water regularly and choose unsweetened or low or no calorie beverages. Caffeine. Its effects vary. Some people will see a mild rise, others none at all. Monitor your own response. Physical activity is another. Movement after meals can blunt spikes and improve insulin sensitivity. Rodriguez's go-to? Pairing hydration with a short post-meal walk. Here are some actionable takeaways for type 1 and type 2 diabetes. The first is count carbohydrates accurately. You can use a tool like MyFitnessPal to track intake. Choose mostly nutrient-dense carbs, things like whole grains, fruits, vegetables, and legumes. But feel free to enjoy small treats occasionally. Next, focus on balance, not elimination. Rodriguez enjoys all foods, emphasizing portions and variety. Pair starches with vegetables and protein, and include non-starchy vegetables, lean protein, beans, and moderate portions of fruit. Next, use your CGM data. Review patterns over time to adjust meal composition, insulin timing, and activity. Move your body. Even short walks after meals improve insulin sensitivity and help stabilize glucose. Remember, mind the hidden factors, things like sleep, stress, hydration, and medications, all of which can be as influential as food choices themselves. And finally, find support and be patient. Each person's diabetes journey is unique. Support coming from a care team, peers, or even family can make all the difference. As Wood says, once you get it, it'll transform your diabetes journey. Managing post-meal blood glucose isn't about perfection. It's about awareness, balance, and flexibility. By learning how carbohydrates, fat, protein, fiber, and everyday factors influence your glucose, you can personalize your approach and respond to your body's unique patterns. Small, consistent adjustments guided by your CGM and your care team can help you feel better, stay in range, and live well with diabetes. Here's a story entitled 11 Smart Strategies to Get Organized. Some simple ways to streamline your space and your diabetes care. It's written by Leslie Josell and Susan Weiner. They are diabetes experts. Leslie, an award-winning ADHD coach, author, speaker, and time management expert, and the principal of a company called Order Out of Chaos. Susan Weiner is the owner and clinical director of Susan Weiner Nutrition and the column editor for Diabetes in Real Life and Nourish to Flourish for Helio. Together, they have written The Complete Diabetes Organizer, your guide to a less stressful and more manageable diabetes life. Life never seems to slow down. Between work, family responsibilities, and the constant stream of daily tasks, it's no surprise that many people want to declutter, get organized, and build healthier routines. But for most of us, the idea of getting started can feel overwhelming. Where do you begin? How do you choose systems that you can actually stick with? Now, add the responsibilities of diabetes management, checking supplies, planning meals, tracking glucose, remembering medications, staying stocked on pump or continuous glucose monitor supplies, and staying organized can just feel even more challenging. The sheer number of decisions you handle each day can leave you feeling scattered and exhausted before you even begin. But good news, you're far from alone. To help you move forward, we've gathered practical, real-world organizing strategies. These are principles that we return to again and again with our clients. Simple things, ideas that you can adapt to your own life to create positive and hopefully lasting change. And here's the most important step. Start with just one change at a time. No one can overhaul everything at once. Give yourself permission to go slowly, be flexible, and treat yourself with kindness along the way. You don't need perfect systems. You just need systems that are organized enough to make life feel a little smoother, a little calmer, and a lot more manageable. Here are some steps. First, start small for big success. Big projects become easier when you divide them into smaller steps. Staring at an entire kitchen or pantry can be daunting, but narrow that focus. It will help you move forward with confidence instead of dread. Begin by asking yourself a few short questions. Can you easily find ingredients and equipment you need? Are your countertops cluttered? Is food prep harder than it needs to be because of that clutter? Are things stored away by fit instead of use? Think, for example, of the mixed nut jar that's shoved in the back corner simply because it fits there, even though you may reach for it every day. Questions like these help you spot your pain points and easily identify places where a small change might make a big difference. Once you're ready to start sorting, organize your pantry items into categories or zones. Keep your spices together, canned goods together, and non-perishable, pre-portioned, lower-carb snacks together. For example, almonds, walnuts, sunflower seeds, and seasoned tuna packets. Seeing everything in one place helps you avoid overbuying and makes it easier to restock strategically. Store your most used items between shoulder height and knee height. That's your prime real estate. Less used items, things like holiday dishes, large platters, and specialty tools, can live on higher shelves or in another room altogether. This simple shift can make your day-to-day cooking, prepping diabetes-friendly snacks, and grabbing your supplies so much easier. Each small success, one clean shelf, one organized drawer, builds momentum. That I can do this spark, it'll make it easier to start the next task and creates a positive feedback loop. When you're overwhelmed, make the first step an easy one. The best way to break through is to start with something so small that success is almost guaranteed. One decision, one drawer, one email, one bill. Tiny steps create real momentum. Treat getting ready to begin as its own task. If your goal is to prepare more meals with lower carb, high fiber vegetables, don't pressure yourself to meal prep the entire week at once. Start by making a grocery list, then decide how those vegetables will fit into a few meals. That first small action will build confidence and reduce resistance. Set daily goals that are short, simple, and specific. Instead of something vague like organize the house, try, on Thursday night, I'll put away the laundry. On Saturday morning, I'll sort mail. After lunch, I'll clean off one shelf in the pantry. The more specific the task, the easier it is to start and to finish. Next, declutter before you buy. Before you rush out to buy organizing tools, sort through what you already have. Declutter first, streamline, and toss or donate what no longer serves you. Only then should you buy new containers. Measuring your spaces and bringing a small tape measure with you prevents frustration and can make shopping much more purposeful. And here's another tip when it comes to containers. Clear is king. Transparent bins let you see what you have at a glance. They're particularly useful for diabetes supplies like test strips, pump infusion sets, sensors, alcohol swabs, and pen needles. And there's no need to overspend. Discount stores and odd lot shops often carry excellent, budget-friendly organizing tools and containers. Next, create a daily launching pad. A launching pad is that single place where you keep the items that go in and out of your home each day. Think keys, phone, gym bag, water bottle, and, crucially, your diabetes supply kit. You should choose a high traffic area, such as near the door, next to the kitchen counter, or in your mudroom. This simple system will prevent forgotten items and cut down on last-minute stress. A bag or a pouch that's designed for diabetes essentials keeps everything you need in one place. For example, insulin, pump, or CGM supplies, fast-acting carbs, snacks, and a cooling pack if necessary. And here's another tip. Create an on-the-go kit that you can grab at a moment's notice. Include your supplies, emergency contact information, and a quick-acting carbohydrate. Add a small checklist so you can quickly review and restock the bag whenever needed. That way, it's always ready to just grab it and go. A solid launching pad will reduce decision fatigue and helps every outing feel much more calm. Next, give everything a home. If you feel like you're always tidying things up but never actually catching up, chances are your belongings simply don't have designated homes. When items lack a defined place, they tend to drift. Keys ending up on the table, supplies ending up on a counter, mail ending up everywhere. Assign each category of items a clear home. Labeling can help too, especially when you're tired or rushed. Visual cues make things easier to find and put away, which helps you maintain your system with less effort. Next, build a command central. Choose one dedicated location to store your core diabetes supplies. Keeping everything together reduces stress, prevents frantic searching, and makes restocking simple. Place that station somewhere that fits your routine, home office, bathroom, or kitchen. The best spot is one you'll actually use consistently. Your command central should also house information that someone else may need in an emergency. A simple binder works beautifully and should include emergency contact information, phone numbers for your care team, a diabetes supply checklist, and clear instructions for recognizing and treating low blood glucose. Embrace digital tools. Reduce paper clutter. It lightens both your home and your mind. Whenever possible, if secure, pay bills online. Scan receipts. Store your medical records in a secure app or a patient portal. And organize your computer like a filing cabinet with clearly labeled folders. The less paper that enters your home, the easier it is to stay on top of the rest. Prep your morning the night before. A calm morning starts with a thoughtful evening. Lay out clothes, prepare breakfast, pack lunches and snacks, and gather everything you'll need into your launching pad. Small steps that will help streamline your routine and ease morning pressure. Next, shape a motivating space, because your surroundings can either help or hinder productivity. Make the spaces where you work or manage your diabetes feel inviting, grounded, and energizing. If you enjoy your environment, you're far more likely to settle in and get things done. Try painting your office your favorite color. Try drinking your morning tea from a mug you love. Try sitting near natural light, which research shows supports focus. Use colorful pens or pretty folders. Add photos or personal touches. Think of your environment as a natural energy booster, one that will encourage you to start and stay with your tasks. Give yourself grace. We all know it's easy to feel frustrated when you procrastinate or fall short of goals. Research does show self-criticism usually makes things harder. Instead, practice self-forgiveness, a reset without judgment, and just start again. A little compassion can restore your energy, your confidence, and your motivation, and make the next step much easier to take. Small changes add up. Choose one strategy to try, build on your progress, and be kind to yourself along the way. A little organization can make everyday life and every part of your diabetes care feel calmer and more doable. And finally, here's a couple of spring insights written by the editor of Diabetes Self-Management, Diane Fennell. Chronic stress, sleep disruption, and hormonal conditions such as Cushing syndrome can raise cortisol levels and your blood sugar along with it. Remember, cortisol can break down. Remember, the cortisol connection breaks down how cortisol works, screening options, and ways to address hormonal imbalances with your healthcare team. When your skin needs extra care, pay attention. Small cuts, calluses, and blisters can turn into bigger problems for people with diabetes. Remember to stay a step ahead of diabetic foot ulcers by discussing with your care providers promising advances in wound care and simple steps that can protect your feet and skin, spot early warning signs, and know when to call your care team. Latent autoimmune diabetes in adults, known as LADA, isn't the only condition that can be mistaken for type 2 diabetes. Early detection of type 1 matters at every age. New information highlighting reasons to get checked, the latest screening tools, and how early diagnosis can lead to more effective treatment is something you can talk about with your care team. Wherever you may be in your diabetes journey, hopefully the information that I've read will help you and offer reassurance, clarity, and motivation, and reminding you that small, consistent actions in your life can add up to powerful protection over time. I'm Scott. It's been a pleasure being with you.